Let's head out to Charlotte. It's Mad Mike. It's the fan. What's going on, Mike? Why are you so mad?
Hey, Moose, I'm doing well. I'm not mad today. I'm real excited about tonight, about Jonah Tong. How do you think it's going to go?
I hope it goes great. How do you not root for a guy to go out there and be very, very good in his major league debut? You're only able to make a debut once, obviously. His family's going to be in attendance. I hope he goes out there and pitches really well.
I'm really, really excited. One question I have, hopefully when they make the playoffs, who's going to pitch in the playoffs? You're going to have Peterson number one. Who are you going to put number two? I would like to see maybe McClain and not these other guys. What do you think?
Well, I think it's TBD. I think you got to see how guys are pitching. I mean, McClain, based on his three starts we've seen up until, if you're going to do it, like if the playoffs start tomorrow, who's in your starting rotation? I would think it would be Nolan McClain, David Peterson, and Kodai Senga.
Got it. Yeah, that makes.
I don't think McClain would be your game one starter, but you get the point. I think those would be your top three.
Yeah, I really do. I'm just excited about these new guys. I mean, Senga, I'm done with him. Manaya, I don't know. I think that it's going to be really good that these new guys come up, breathe some life, some energy. I think it could propel us to some good things in the playoffs.
Yeah, well, and that's where I talked about the dangerous aspect or the fear factor when you're looking at the New York Mets. And I think that is, now, they've got to back it up. Like, last night was a terrible performance. There's no other way to cut it. And, you want to, make the argument that they've turned a corner after sweeping away the Philadelphia Phillies and taking 2-3 against the Braves. And you're saying to yourself, all right, well, the Mets have looked a lot better. The resurgence of Mark Vientos, McClain, 0.89 ERA, three major league starts. And then last night, they go out there and embarrass themselves against the Marlins and lose the game 7-4 and make three errors in the field, which leads to 500 runs. And all of a sudden, that confidence that he had in the New York Mets. Now, what they can have is have that marinate. They can't have that go out, and they've got to nip this one in the bud, and that's why Tong's start tonight and their performance tonight against the Miami Marlins. See, you look at the Philadelphia Phillies, they just got swept, and what did they do to the Atlanta Braves last night? Well, Schwarber hits four home runs, and they scored 19 runs. And they took out their frustration after the series against the New York Mets, and now they're all of a sudden their lead once again in the National League East is back up to 5 games. So you can't have one bad performance now lead to another. And the Mets need to bounce back tonight with Tong on the mound against Miami.
I think they will. I'm excited about it. Thank you, Moose.
You got it, Mike. And don't be so mad down in Charlotte. All right? Life is good. Keyport, New Jersey. It's Sal. It's the fan. What's going on, Sal?
What's up there, Moose? How are you?
I'm doing great, Sal. How are you?
So am I. I'm in my backyard. It's Christmas in August. I am so happy that Jerry Jones is such a stubborn guy. It's simple as that. Why do you give up a guy? Send him to a team like the Carolina Panthers. Why are you sending him to the Green Bay Packers, which I am ecstatic about? Now we got a clear shot at the Super Bowl. I really think we're a contender now. I honestly do. It's something that's going to solidify the defense. Thank you,
well,
Jerry Jones.
Sal, how's your backyard? Do you have a pool? Barbecue? What do you got?
No, we got rid of the pool, and we put down 355 16x16 paver stones. My wife, me, and my son. I have a pitching putt in my backyard. It's a one-hole practice green, which is about 24 feet long and 8 feet wide. I have my fire pit, my gazebo, my porch,
nice.
And some wildcats just.
Well, Sal, I'm gonna put you on hold.
Okay, brother.
Give us your address because Hoff wants to stop by later on today.
Anytime you want, bro.
You can entertain him. Yeah,
100%.
Yeah, he'll bring him and his kids. He wants to know if they can cut him loose.
I wish I could send you guys. I wish I could send you guys pictures of the backyard.
It sounds beautiful, Sal.
Such a great yard.
I mean,
it really is.
You're proud as a peacock about your backyard as well. I get a sense.
My wife and I also.
That's the beautiful thing about owning a home.
Yes, it is. It really is. Well, thank you for taking my call.
You got it, Sal. Enjoy your great Labor Day weekend. And have fun today. It's Sal. Pitch and putt. He's got a putting green. He's got it all. Pavers, fire pit. He's got it all. I mean, he could cut the kids loose. Drop them off, go back home, fold laundry, put it away. Have your wife teach you. You'd be good to go. I don't disagree with you, Sal. Like, I think yesterday was a good day for the Green Bay Packers. And I do think Christmas came a little bit early. And I think Green Bay went out there. And even though Brian Gutekunst, their general manager, could tell you and did on a numerous different occasions, even as early as, I don't know, or as late as like 3 or 4 days ago, saying, you know, where it's not necessarily just being one player away. The Green Bay Packers, if you're looking at pressure rate and getting after the quarterback a year ago, it was not what you need to be an impact defense. And now they've added one of the premier edge rushers in the National Football League. So, yeah, the Packers, to me, are one of those teams. Now, the big question with them is, what version are you going to get of Jordan Love? If you get a really good version of Jordan Love, if you get the version that he was a couple years ago, then the Green Bay Packers could get themselves out to the Bay Area, you know, north of San Francisco in the Super Bowl this year in February. They could. They could be one of those teams. And I think Micah Parsons is going to be extremely motivated with how everything ended down in Dallas with the Cowboys. Phillip in Brooklyn's up next to the Fan. What's going on, Phil?
Hey, Mark, thanks a lot for taking my call. Enjoying my retirement from Gun Hill Depot. It's been a few months now. As a Giants fan,
well, that's
and I
it.
Know you're
Popo and the guys over at Gun Hill. I remember, Phillip. There's no doubt.
No doubt, man. During the overnight, talking to you, that was great going to work in the morning.
Love
I'm not
it.
Missing going to work in the morning, but
I'm
just talking
Phil.
To you, though.
I appreciate the love, man. I used to love the calls from Gun Hill Depot at 3-4 in the morning, no doubt.
Hey, you look, I'm a Giants fan. I know you're a Washington fan. I'm happy. Look, I didn't like Michael Parsons only because he talked too much. That was my, my thing, you know, whether it's the podcast or whatever the case may be, you know what I mean? In terms of his impact on the field, yes, he was a terror against the Giants. You know what I'm saying? We don't have to worry now, in my opinion, about the Cowboys' pass rush. As a Giants fan, I don't even know if we're at the bottom of the barrel now in the division. Does Dallas have, two good wide receivers? Yes, but they don't have a running game. I'm not satisfied with the Giants' running game either. I wish Jackson Dart could start a lot sooner than maybe they plan to start him, which I don't know when they do. But in terms of Jerry Jones trying to spin this as, okay, all he can do is rush the passer and we can't stop the run. Well, that's been going on for years. So now you can't rush the passer either. So whether or not Dallas wins this, trade, we won't know for another 2 to 3 years.
Well, Phillip, I think depending on if Green Bay wins the Super Bowl, they win the trade.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. I mean, the Packers are making this move because they feel like they're in a window where they can compete and win a Super Bowl. So if they do that.
It depends on what Jordan Love does. Yeah.
Right. But they win the deal. From a Cowboy perspective, you want to look at it kind of, through the layers is this. The Cowboys were so inept, whether it be free agency or the draft, that they felt as an organization, what was best for them is to not allocate the money to pay a truly great player in the NFL, but gain the assets to be able to make up for other deficiencies on the roster.
That's how they're spinning it. Mark, come on, Mark. I'm not believing that. If that was the case, then you wouldn't have paid Dak Prescott $60 million.
Well, but here's the deal. Like, how do you make the argument? How do you go out there and tell me about stopping the run with Kenny Clark last night if you're Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones? Like, how do you look at it? Listen, for a Giant fan, Phillip, you don't care. You're enjoying retirement. You know what? The sun is shining. I mean, you don't care. It was a great Thursday night.
Jerry Jones
don't have to deal with number 11 as a Cowboy anymore.
That's right. Jerry Jones and Cowboy fans, their feelings are hurt. That's what it is. And they're just trying to spin it. Anytime, how can you be a Cowboy fan, right, and not be hurt today? You have to be. And I heard a lot of Cowboy fans, including Jerry Jones, trying to spin it as, oh, we're a better team. You're not a better team this year. You're not going to the playoffs. And those draft picks next year, who knows what they're going to turn out to be. The Giants have failed on first-round draft picks. Now, Cowboys have been pretty good, but we'll see.
Well, and so have a lot of other teams, and you're not wrong. And then they add the caveat to, we might be able to use some of that draft capital to acquire talent that can help us this year. Well, we've been thinking about this for a while. The idea, and you heard Jerry mispronounce Micah's name a number of times, calling him Michael, not Micah, and then corrected himself on one occasion. But, listen, he's 82. But, it was a tough listen to last night. In the end, the Giants made out. I mean, in the end, if you're Phillip in Brooklyn, if you're a Giant fan, and you can go out there and say, well, the Giants are no longer a laughingstock. I heard Lou Gower making that point yesterday. And, there's other people that, the Cowboys have taken the reins. Well, the Cowboys are still going to be competitive this year. It's not like they're all of a sudden going to be a doormat. Like, I don't think they're all of a sudden going to have a top five pick in the NFL draft. The different, the aspect of it is, though, they're a significantly weaker team. And I like Kenny Clark as a player. He's just not nearly as impactful or as dynamic as what Micah Parsons presents when you're trying to put together a defense, and what he can do and how you can line him up all over the place and how he can get after the quarterback. To be honest with you, that's the key. You know, for the Giants, we've talked about lack of identity on defense. Well, this year, defensively, the Giants are going to have an identity. The Cowboys just lost a big piece of their identity on defense. The Giants, you know, win in this deal. They're not dealing with the Green Bay Packers. We're not talking about the Giants winning a Super Bowl this year. We're not even talking about the Giants winning the NFC East this year. But what you want to see from the Giants this year is the competitiveness against really good football teams, where it looks the part. Because there's one thing where, you know, stats, final score tell you something. It doesn't necessarily tell you all the whole story. And as we're watching, you know, Jet and Giant football throughout the course of the year, each week, 17 games, 18 weeks throughout the regular season, you know, and you're watching the Giants, you want to come out of it where the Giants this season have shown significant growth as an organization, where they're better off for 2026, where you can start to think about making the postseason consistently, where you can look at this team being relevant consistently. That's what you want to see. That's the goal. Not the one-year outlier that we saw 3 years ago where they went to the playoffs in Daniel Jones and won a playoff game in Minnesota and then went back into the abyss the next 2 years. Dallas can rationalize it all they want. They can tell you whatever they want to tell you, and they're going to spin it and say that they're better off not paying a great player. You don't want to let really talented, great players leave the building. And we saw it a year ago when Saquon left in free agency. Do we not? It was a long season. Not only with the Giants' performance on the field, but what Barkley did for the Philadelphia Eagles on the field. Road to Cooperstown podcast with John Morosi is really cool. Fox Sports, John is on, and MLB Network does a great job. Podcast part of the MLB Network channel in collaboration with SiriusXM. Where he talks about Hall of Famers and talks to Hall of Famers and chatted with Wade Boggs, obviously the legendary Red Sox, legendary Yankee. Boggs tells the story of how he came to sign with the Yankees during George Steinbrenner's suspension years.
Mrs. Yawkey was still alive. She says, Wade, I want you to be a Red Sox player for life. The beginning of January, she slips and falls in a tub and dies. I go to spring training in 92. They take the offer off the table. First team to call are the Dodgers. The next morning, the Yankees call. We sit down, have a conversation. Joe Malloy goes, would 3 years, $11 million put you in pinstripes? I said, I think you got a new player that's going to put pinstripes on. And there's a gentleman sitting at a table over here reading a newspaper, and a newspaper comes down, and it's George, and he winks at me. And he was listening to the whole conversation.
There you have it. I love that story. I love getting those backstories, and John joins us now. Hey, John, Mark Malusa is with you. Thanks for the time this afternoon.
Moose, I am outstanding, and I smile every time I hear Wade's story because I did not know that, obviously, and so to know that George Steinbrenner, as if it's a movie scene, is sitting at the next table and then the newspaper comes down. One of my favorite stories, Moose, that I've heard while doing the Road to Cooperstown podcast.
Yeah, it's great. And John, listen, I love the backstories. First off, you appreciate the players for their greatness and what they were able to accomplish, but everything that goes along with it, whether it be the big games, Boggs leaving in free agency, signing with the Yankees, obviously the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry. I love this series on the podcast because not only you learn a little something, but you hear stories you never heard before.
Well, Moose, you're exactly right. And one of my favorite lines on interviewing, and I wish I remembered who said it first, but the line is this. It is amazing what people will tell you when they know how the story ends. And that means basically that once you've got a player who's already in Cooperstown, they're not going to take the plaque away. Okay, so the stories are what they are. And now that a player knows where he is for all of baseball immortality, you get some different things than if it's a post-game interview at Citi Field or Yankee Stadium on a Tuesday night in May. It's different. And I've heard some pretty remarkable stories. I've had people like Larry Walker, someone who you would not expect to break down in tears, because you really get a sense, Moose, for how much Cooperstown means to them. And I really believe the more years that go on, And you just think about the arc of a life story and players who then get to their 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, they think less about the plaque and the numbers and more about the relationships. And one of the things that I've heard from multiple Hall of Famers, Moose, is that on your first induction, it's Johnny Bench who sits you down on the veranda of the Otisaga there and overlooking Lake Otsego there in Cooperstown, and tells the new Hall of Famers to sit down, pause, and look around this beautiful lake and all the people around you, the immortals of the game. And I come to believe, Moose, just from talking to a lot of these players, it's those moments, it's Johnny Bench telling you to sit down and take it all in, that matters even more than the numbers themselves.
I'm sure it does. I mean, that's really cool. John, I want to ask you about Boggs here. You know, 86, the heartbreak with the Red Sox. And, you know, I was in the building in 96 with my older sister, Kim, watching Wade on the horse, the police horse, right. You know, on the field at Yankee Stadium after they knocked off the Braves in game 6. What about that, you know, that 10-11 years here, what he wasn't able to accomplish in Boston and what he ultimately accomplished here in New York with the Yankees?
You know, Moose, it's a great question. It's one of the stories that stood out to me the most about Boggs. And there's this image, if you're a Red Sox fan or a Met fan, certainly a lot of Yankee fans watch the 86 series carefully, there's this indelible image of Boggs in tears in the dugout after the Red Sox lost game 7, a game 7 that, by the way, despite all that happened in game 6, they still led early in that game. And so they end up losing game 7. And what Wade told me, Moose, that really stood out to me is that the reason why he was so overcome with emotion, yes, he was devastated to have lost game 7 of the World Series after coming so close in game 6, but his mother had died in an automobile accident earlier that year. And Wade told me that he had basically bottled up that sense of grief of losing his mom in the middle of the season because there was always one more game to play. And he just packed in that grief and that emotion and heartbreak every day because, okay, I've got 9 innings tomorrow. I've got to get 2 or 3 hits. And it just kept going and going and going until all of a sudden there was no more game to play. And wow. That was what Wade said, that it hit him that not only had he lost a baseball game, but on a much more important human level, he had lost his mom. And he was then finally confronted with the grief of that he had just kind of tucked away inside of himself for all those months. And it was one of the more emotional moments I've heard someone talk about during the course of the podcast. And then to fast forward 10 years, more tears at a different ballpark in New York, only this time, as you're describing, Moose, you saw it with your own eyes, he's on the back of the horse, and he's finally a World Series champion, and he's crying again in a very different way a decade later. So just, you know, growing up as he was the son of a military man that moved around so much, Tampa became home. He had these different chapters of his story, but I think it was that discipline and the way that he was able to approach the game that ultimately led him to that 96 World Series, even though, Moose, as you remember well, he had lost playing time in that series.
He
they
did.
Lost the first 2 games, but it was that pinch hit walk. You remember in game 3 in Atlanta that changed the whole series around. And so even though his role had been diminished, I believe firmly, and you probably do too, the Yankees do not win that World Series without him coming off the bench, drawing a walk, and turning the whole series around there in game 3 in Atlanta.
No, and John, in today's day and age, you know, I really have a deep appreciation of watching Boggs, you know, because the batting average, because in today's day and age, nobody cares about batting average anymore. And when I watched Boggs, all it was about batting average. He was an unbelievable, his approach at the plate and watching him day in and day out, whether it was with Boston or whether in New York here with the Yankees or Tampa, you know, deserve it, obviously, Hall of Fame and immortal and all-time great, but his approach at the plate was ridiculous.
Yeah, it was. And it was interesting, Moose, to hear Boggs describe this. His approach at the plate was inextricably linked to all those superstitions. Now, he gave me the estimate. He said that when he was going through his career, that he had more than 80 superstitions that he did a day. More than 80.
That's insane.
Now, it is. And he admits and acknowledges that it was his own way, and he fully agrees and understands there was a lot of compulsions, mental compulsions that were all part of it. But he said the goal of all of those compulsions, if you can believe it, was to basically tire himself out mentally such that once he got in the batter's box, He was so exhausted from all the superstitions, and his brain was just blank. Now, think about that. In contrast, that with a modern player. You've got iPads everywhere. We are awash in data, information, launch angles, swing mechanics, degrees of openness of your stance, and bat path and everything else. Wade Boggs told me, Moose, the whole goal for him was to basically be completely mentally worn down from all the, you know, tracing the chi in the dirt and all the different things he did, the chicken and everything else. It was the goal of having his mind be completely vacant. Can you believe that?
I can't believe that.
Now we're in the total opposite world. It's like the exact polar opposite. You've got to have as much information as possible. I don't know to the modern players. Granted, I was not a very good player myself. But all I know is this. The dude with the highest batting average of any player alive, retired or active, his goal
was to exhaust himself mentally before he stepped in the batter's box.
What, exactly. Was to think nothing, see ball, hit ball. That was his goal. I don't know, everybody. It worked for him, and it worked for George Brett, and so maybe they're onto something. But again, Mark, I'm going to say that, and someone's going to say to me on Twitter today, hey, man, what do Wade Boggs and George Brett know about hitting? I don't know, guys. Check the numbers.
Yeah, they were pretty good. John, one more on Boggs. I want to get your thoughts on the Mets and the Yankees. Is what team did Boggs say was the best team he was ever on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that – so the – I don't remember the exact phraseology that it gave me, but when you consider the way that Yankee team came together later on in his career, I think he saw this the different constellation of stars be really special, but also that 86 team. You look at how many Hall of Famers, or could have been Hall of Famers, when you think about Clemens as well, and even someone like a Dwight Evans. I mean, he played on some significant teams, and I think it's I credit Wade for this, Moose, that he's able to, I think, have the Red Sox part of his legacy and the Yankees part of his legacy coexist in a way that I feel like, and you would know this better as a New Yorker, I think he is able to have those two things cohere and exist, coexist, in a way that I think for Clemens it's been hard, and for Damon it's been hard. I think Boggs, in a certain way, is able to make it work, and maybe it's because Red Sox fans understand the story that you heard him tell about Mrs. Yawkey wanting him to be a Red Sox for life, but then she passes away and it doesn't happen. I think they understand that it really wasn't his fault as to why he didn't return to Boston.
We're talking to John Morosi. Check out the new podcast, or the podcast Road to Cooperstown. It's in conjunction with MLB Network Channel and also SiriusXM. It's fantastic. And talking about the Boggs, the latest one with Wade Boggs. John, I want to ask you about the Mets and the Yankees here.
Sure.
You know, you look at Nolan McClain. I mean, he's been, downright brilliant in his three starts. Jonah Tong tonight. When you look at this Met team, five games in back of the Philadelphia Phillies in the National League East. I've talked about they're a dangerous team if they're able to find that magic from a year ago. What's your take on the Mets right now?
Really interesting. And I think that when you consider McClain and Tong coming up this late in the game, there's this, I think it's a misconception that you've got to have all this experience to be able to win. Because at some point in time, obviously, you think about the 96 Yankees, Jeter was a very young player, just to use one example, and even the 86 Mets that we talked about before. It's always someone's first time. And if this team gets going, and the big question is, if Tong is dominant, and again, we haven't even seen him pitch yet, so who knows exactly how it's going to all play out, but McClain certainly has been. He is very clearly the real deal, which I think in a lot of ways probably gives Met fans a confidence that, hey, we're developing pitchers the right way, and by the time they get to Flushing, they're ready to pitch and perform. I fully expect the Mets to be the second-place team in the division. I think they'll win a wild card. They'll hold off the Reds. I was just in Philly last night for Schwarber's four-homer game. I don't think that team's going to totally collapse, even though I do have some worries about their pitching without Wheeler. The Mets, I look at as being a very dangerous team in the wild card round to be able to get through there. And then at that point, trust these kids. If they show you that they can perform, I don't know how much more of a pressurized environment McClain would feel in the playoffs, as we know, are a different level. But he comes up and faces the Mariners, a good playoff team in the American League, at a time where the Mets rotation is begging for some consistency, and he just deals. So he's for me, he's proven his mettle in a pennant race in New York. The playoffs are a different octave, but I look at McClain, especially based on what we've seen. He is not a guy that's going to be afraid of the big stage, Moose. I feel as confident as I could feel in a rookie pitching in the playoffs. That's how I feel about Nolan McClain.
Yeah, and you were in the building last night. You saw the Phillies take out their frustration, John, on the Atlanta Braves and Schwarber with the four home runs. But there is no doubt. I mean, when they go to Queens, they're a different baseball team. I mean, that was an impressive sweep by the New York Mets. Without Wheeler in that starting rotation, you don't think they're going to collapse, but how dangerous do you think this Philadelphia team will be?
Well, I think they're going to have to win games a little bit differently than they had expected. Again, Wheeler, it's hard to underscore how big of a loss that is. I mean, it's a Cy Young candidate as a pitcher for them often. You know, Nola showed last night he was a little wobbly in the first inning. He almost had to leave the game early, but was able to stabilize. And they're heavily dependent on their lefties, okay? Sanchez, Suarez, and Lusardo. So if you get a team, and in that way, you think about the Mets, especially with Alonso, this is a team that can do some damage against left-handed pitching, I still think, in the course of a playoff series, to where if the Phillies run up against a team with serious right-handed power, they could be in trouble. Now, their bullpen has been stabilized a bit. By the way, David Robertson is again found the fountain of youth.
Crazy.
Rob Thompson said, Rob Thompson told me yesterday, he said, Robertson's in better shape now than when he debuted as a rookie with the Yankees in 2008. He can just keep doing it. I said hello to David yesterday, big smile on his face. And the joke, of course, is, hey, if you only got to work a half season a year, feeling great. You still, you know, play half a season, show up, go to the playoffs, and you're in a great, great frame of mind. So, he's been really good. Duran, obviously, is excellent as a back of the game, too. So they're definitely not the scary team that I thought they would be. And I do think, as much as I love the Phillies lineup, there's opportunity there. There's opportunity for a team like the Padres with that amazing bullpen. There's opportunity for the Mets. And I think you saw, as sort of wobbly as the bullpen looked right after the trade deadline with Helsley, that will find its level eventually. And I honestly, I feel as strongly about the Mets' chances of making a run in October than I do, maybe even more so than I do about the Yankees. I just think that the Mets, I have a little better sense of what they're all about. And if you're able to sweep the Phillies at home at this time of year, it says a lot about where you're at as a ball club.
Yeah, John, you stole the next one, you know, and I want to get your thoughts on the Yankees before we let you go. And that is, you know, they beat up on the Nats. Do I learn anything? No. They beat up on the White Sox last night. They hit a ton of home runs. Have I learned anything? Not necessarily. Like, I think the next 12 games after this White Sox series, when they're playing, you know, upper echelon teams, if you can call it that, in the American League, you're going to learn a little something before the soft landing spot at the end of the season for the New York Yankees. Get concerned about this Yankee team, John, when you look at it in terms of the sloppiness in the field, sloppiness in the base pass, whether or not they can generate offense, if they can't generate the home run. What's your take overall on this Yankee team? Freed's been better last two starts. Rodon's been good. Schlittler's been good. Back into the bullpen, getting the ball, obviously, to their closer has been an issue at times. What's your take on where the Yankees are right now?
Yeah, and you mentioned a name in Schlittler who I think has been underrated nationally a bit for how good he's been. I think Bednar, since his first appearance, has really stabilized well. Here's the question I've got. Actually, I've got two questions with this team. Number one, unlike last year, when you had Soto, who was like at the peak of his powers, one of the reasons why this team made the playoff or made the World Series last year is that pitchers, I think, were in a bit of a panic as to who they could attack, who they had to pitch around, because you couldn't pitch around all of Soto, Stanton, and Judge all the time. Couldn't do that. And I wonder, is there anybody in the lineup, and maybe it's Stanton, we'll see how it all plays out based on who's able to, you know, can Judge play in the field, et cetera. Who is there that's going to be able to attract enough attention from the other teams such that Aaron Judge sees any pitches to hit? That to me is different than last year. Soto was, yeah, the right-left balance, et cetera. There was a team that could say, listen, we're either not going to let Soto beat us or we're not going to let Judge beat us. I just wonder, and we saw Judge at times just not see pitches to hit. He didn't have a great series against the Royals. And even the Guardians, it was still hit and miss. I just wonder, when you look at Judge, how many pitches he is going to see to hit. And also, like last night, they were able to overcome the defensive miscue early on from Volpe.
Yep.
But you can't do that against good teams.
No, you can't.
If you give good teams extra outs, they will beat you. And I think my big picture point, Moose, on the AL and NL sides right now, I've been fortunate to cover this great game for about 20 years. I have never seen a postseason that is this wide open. I love this game. I cover it every day. I got no idea what's going to happen. And that's a good thing, okay? It's good to have unexpected. And that's where if someone says, hey, John, the World Series is going to be Milwaukee against Seattle, that guess is as good as mine because I have no idea what's going to happen. And if the Yankees get knocked out in their first round, that could happen. They could be back in the World Series. It's a different group. There's no Garrett Cole like there was last year, but Fried's been better, to your point. So it's almost like day-to-day, and I love it's about baseball. You can almost convince yourself that this team is going to figure it out, and then the next day they lose 9-2, and you're like, oh, my gosh, what's going to happen? That's why I think we're in such an unexpected spot with Major League Baseball right now.
John Morosi, Fox Sports MLB Network. Check out his podcast, The Road to Cooperstown Podcast. It's a fantastic listen for any baseball fan. Hey, John, appreciate the time this afternoon. Have a great Labor Day weekend, all right?
Moose, you do a great job on the show. I'm honored to be on it with you here, and have a great and safe holiday weekend as well.
You got it. Always good to talk a little bit of baseball, and he talks about the wide-open nature of Major League Baseball. We'll touch upon that as well. I'm morphing into Jimmy Johnson right in front of our YouTube eyes. Thank you. Yes, I do have gray hair. Yes. My son asked me about that the other day, and I said, well, what would you like, me to lose it, or do you want like it to turn gray? It's one or the other. Like, why is your hair turning gray? Stress. To be perfectly honest with you, you three. I didn't blame them. I'm just kidding. I didn't put the guilt on them. Maybe a little bit. But it is, yes, that's true. Stress of life. My hair has turned. I wish it didn't, to be honest with you. I wish I was still at, you know, the dirty blonde hair that I had the majority of my life. But yes, my hair is turning gray. Or as one makeup artist put it, your hair is platinum. And I said, well, maybe I should dye it. She's like, don't you dye it. I go, why not? You don't think it'll look good? No, it will not. I dyed my hair once when I was at SNY, and it was very, very obvious. I went in to go get get my hair cut, and at that point in time at SNY, we had deals with like this salon. Cutler Salon was great down in Lower Manhattan, and the guy that was cutting my hair, I was like, yeah, my hair is, you know, turning gray a little bit. He goes, oh, you know what? We'll take care of that. I'll dye it. I'm like, really? How long will that take? 30, 40 minutes. You don't have long hair. It'll be good. It'll look great. So he dyed it. I walked out, and it was a darker shade than I had imagined. And so that was like on a, I would say like a mid-afternoon Friday. And I walked in, and this is when SNY, we were located downtown, Lower Manhattan. This is right when we were across the street from Radio City Music Hall. Now the MLB store is there. And I walked in downstairs, past the security guard. He didn't say anything. And then walked downstairs. And first person I saw said, he goes, oh, nice dye job. It's like, thanks. It wasn't supposed to be that obvious. Is it that obvious? I'm like, yeah, it's really obvious. Does it look good? Looks okay. I'm like, all right, that was the last of it. Then I had a complex. Then I was like, ugh, it must look bad. Someone's pointing it out right away. Frank and Scotch Plains, but it's stress. That's really what it comes down to. And thanks for the love on social media. Frank, what's on your mind, buddy?
Hey, Moose. How are you, man?
Good, happy Frank. Friday. How you doing, buddy?
Good, good. Hey, listen, as you probably know, I'm a huge Giants fan, okay? I agree with, it's good news for us, most certainly. The only thing is, it doesn't make the Giants better. It just makes the Cowboys worse. That's the first thing. And secondly, we can't forget, we passed up on Micah Parsons. So that was the worst. That was even, that's worse than this, but that's forgotten because that's in the past. Right. So let's not forget that. But the bottom line is this, right? If you take a step back and you look at it, you're like, the Cowboys, do you think the Cowboys were going to win a Super Bowl next year, this year?
Nothing to do with it.
I get it. But what's his name again? Jerry Jones? Jerry Jones.
Yeah,
Jerry
I told Jones, the Jimmy yeah. Johnson reference from Chris on social media right. Because my hair's turning gray.
Yeah.
But yes, Jerry Jones.
I mean, listen, I don't know what happened there. I don't know what happened there. It's not like he can't afford it, right? I mean, what was the difference? What was the differential that made it Was it?
I don't know.
Was
it Frank, I don't know where the Cowboys were at the end with Micah Parsons. Jerry was asked about that last night. He wouldn't really give you the financial numbers.
Yeah.
He referenced the fact that the Cowboys offered him more guaranteed money than the reported deal that he got with the Green Bay Packers. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I'll take his word for it. That's true. I don't know what the structure of the deal was. So, yeah, I mean, Frank, you can look at it. It's the Giants have to worry about themselves. I don't disagree with you there.
That's right.
Like, the Giants have got enough to worry about, and they got to think about themselves. But if you're looking within the division, you know, I think if you're a Giant fan, you say, thank you, Mr. Jones.
Yeah, like, no, it's great.
I think you're appreciative of the fact that he decided to trade a premier edge rusher that teams fall over themselves to try and get to the Green Bay Packers because he's trying to build strength in numbers. And he can now allocate those finances to pay other players of quality. And that he's going to bring three or four guys that are going to make the equivalent of what he would have had to have paid Micah Parsons. That's all.
Right. My bigger concern is this. I don't care about the Cowboys. Fine. It's good news that they're weaker. That's fine. I'm happy with that. But my bigger concern is the Giant offensive line. Dart, great. I think it's going to work. All that. You know, defense looks good. Offensive line, it feels like centuries, decades, that they have not been able to address that. If that's not fixed, we still have problems, and we'll still be in last place this year. That's my opinion.
Frank, the biggest issue is Thomas being healthy at left tackle. You're not wrong. We've been talking about the offensive line issues for the Giants for a while. Let's head out to Rockaway. It's Alan. What's going on, Alan?
Hey, Moose. Good to talk to you. I think he might actually have some ulterior motives here. You got Arch Manning there in Texas. The team, Dallas, didn't even look that great last year. You get rid of one of your best players on defense, and then next thing you know, okay, you got a couple extra draft picks, and maybe you trade up and get Arch Manning, or maybe you guys play bad enough to get a top pick. You know what I mean? I'm just thinking another perspective he may be looking at. He's getting up there, you know?
No, he is getting it. So wouldn't that be more of the impetus to try and win now instead of playing the long game with Arch Manning or rolling the dice about whether or not you're going to be worse enough to be able to move up? And then if you're not able to get the top overall pick in the draft, and so you're going to sacrifice a year Dak Prescott, and you're going to tell, you know, you're hoping and you're rooting for your team to lose week in and week out, that then you're hoping to have the worst record in the NFL, and you're hoping that Arch Manning decides to come out after 1 year at Texas.
Right, I do think it's far-fetched, but I'm just saying, the guy, he's a quarterback at the University of Texas right now, the pedigree, you never know what Jerry Jones is thinking. I'm just thinking maybe he's thinking that in that direction. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Alan, I think you want to win. You know, I talked to Javon Holland, who came over from Miami with the Giants, and we know that the Giants face a very difficult schedule, and he's not looking at, you know, the win totals of the year or the Giants' odds or anything like that. And he basically said, if you're a member of this team and your goal is not to win the division, win the conference, and go to the Super Bowl, I really don't have too much time for you. Because that's the way you have to think if you're a football player. So, you know, if you're Jerry Jones, could you be thinking... You know, I don't think, like I mentioned before, I don't think the Cowboys are going to be as bad as New Orleans is. And maybe New Orleans doesn't end up being as bad as I think they're going to be. But I don't think they're going to be one of the worst teams in the National Football League. And let's see what Arch Manning is, too. We've seen him in short stretches for the Texas Longhorns. We know he has the pedigree, but he's got a big game tomorrow night against Ohio State.